Good morning. I'm Evan Smith. I'm editor-in-chief and CEO of the Texas Tribune. I'm very pleased to welcome Jill Abramson, who has been executive editor of the New York Times since September of 2001. She previously served 8 years as the paper's managing editor, during which time she helped supervise coverage of 2 wars, 4 national elections, hurricanes, and oil spills, and took more than a passing interest in the paper's digital evolution, which we'll spend some time talking about today. Her tenure at the Times, which began in 1997, also includes 3 years as Washington bureau chief. For 9 years, beginning in 1988, Ms. Abramson worked at the Wall Street Journal, serving as deputy Washington bureau chief and as an investigative reporter. She's the author of several books, including Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas, which was a nonfiction finalist for the National Book Award, Where They Are Now, the story of the women of Harvard Law in 1974, and The Puppy Diaries, Raising a Dog Named Scout, published last fall. Please join me in welcoming Jill Abramson. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Evan.
So let me start out with the optimism question, which is to say, is there cause for optimism? Is this a good time or a bad time to be in the newspaper business, and specifically to be the editor of a paper like The Times?
It's a fantastic time to be editor of The Times, and I'm optimistic about quality journalism and its future and the fact that it's an essential part of society.
What specifically American makes you optimistic? What you're saying I can't argue with. It is an essential part of society, but we also know that the media business has been pretty much beaten about the head and face over the last few years. And the big papers have problems that may be larger but are not significantly different from the smaller papers. So get specific, if you would. What's there to be optimistic about specifically?
Reporting and quality news and going in depth and being, you know, an eyewitness, having boots on the ground. That's the way that we've covered, you know, the so-called Arab Spring so well.
Yeah.
And yeah, we have never cut our news gathering muscle, which makes our news report and the leadership of the Times itself really different. We took a different way through the really difficult years.
Yeah. The 15 years you've been there, obviously the media business has changed and the Times has changed. But as you look back on those 15 years, what are the most significant changes, one or two or three, that you've seen? How is the paper different from 1997 till today?
Well, I mean, it's tremendously different to today. And I'd have to say, you know, when I first came to the Times from the Journal in 97 was really when the website was taking off.
Yeah.
But from there to here is just tremendously different. But that would be, you know, number one. Number two is, like, at the point that I joined the Times in the late 90s, we had just finished a key part of our evolution from essentially in the 60s a local paper with emphasis on the New York of the New York Times, and we'd become a fully national newspaper by then.
Yeah.
And right now the part of the transition that we're in is going global, where through our you know, ownership of the IHT and partnership in journalism with them, you know, expanding our footprint. And we have a new great blog project called India Inc. going on in India. So I'd say now is, you know, it's a global news report, and we're pushing that out. That'd be big change too.
I'm curious about the metered model, as I suspect people in this room are. It's been almost a year. In fact, your predecessor, Bill Keller, was supposed to be at this conference last year. The tsunami kept him from being
here.
That's
what he said.
Do you know differently? But he was going to talk about, at that point, what was the impending arrival of the metered model. But you've had about a year under your belts now. And many of us remember the days of Times Select, the bad old days of Times Select, which was an earlier attempt to try to put some of the content behind a wall. That didn't work. Do you perceive that this is working from an economic standpoint, and do you perceive that this is working from a content standpoint so far?
I think it's working from both of those perspectives. That, you know, we always felt that the quality of our news report stood apart, that and that the people who are most addicted addicted to it are real loyalists, that it was really reasonable to ask them to pay for it. And, you know, it turned out happily that, you know, timing is everything, and Time Select, you're right, you know, didn't work for a variety of reasons, but... Yeah, we're really pleased with the number of people who have signed up for digital subscriptions. Yeah. And, you know, our last report was the fourth quarter, and that was 390,000. And it's a nice revenue stream. You know, what supported the newspaper all of through the last century was having two revenue streams, advertising and circulation, and it seems to me to be 100% advertising dependent, while, you know, we have very robust digital advertising is, you know, it's just a good way to secure our future. And by turning mainly to our biggest loyalists, we remained free for the, you know, vast majority of people who visit our site, and very much part of the discussion in the open web. And so it feels a little bit like we have the best of both worlds.
Was there a feeling within the Times that by having the content be freely available to everybody at no cost on the site that you were seeing circulation decline? Was there that you could make that a causal relationship prior to the metered model being introduced? Was that the...
That was not the driver. Yeah. And, you know, an odd benefit that we didn't predict of going to the metered model was that actually circulation for the print paper rose, especially for the Sunday paper. So people found they they really were deep readers of the report digitally, but that it was nice to sit with the print paper on Sunday too.
Yeah. So, from a content standpoint, what has been the biggest impact of the metered model?
You know, I don't think it really has had an impact on the news report itself, which is, you know, very ambitious in its goals, covers, you know, a huge array of subject areas, and always will.
But you haven't made decisions editorially with the knowledge that a certain number of people, unless they're paying customers, are going to be barred from accessing.
No.
Yeah. Hasn't changed your mind.
No, and, you know, I'm always, because my background is in deep investigative reporting, that, you know, the most popular articles are often the long, very challenging pieces that we do, kind of going behind the curtain and digging for the story behind the story, which is my passion. That's right. What I bring to, you know, the job of executive editor, and that's for all readers, whether they're subscribers or visitors.
It's a hopeful sign to think that, you know, we're told for so long that what the web is not good at is long form.
I know, but that's false.
Yeah. Well, you at least in your own case are seeing
evidence. Oh, I think it's false, and as we progress in terms of our digital sophistication, I think you know, the way that you can tell those stories has become more powerful. And
I think also the way you tell them is also non-traditional. You know, the Times has been particularly good at non-traditional storytelling, mm-hmm. through interactives and visualizations,
right.
And the sort of the Aaron Pilhofer suite of stuff, you know.
What readers want.
Right.
So
that stuff, you would agree, is important to being able to keep people interested.
Absolutely. I think what I like to think of it as is like an organic part of digesting our stories is readers come with the expectation that, you know, a deep profile of someone like Amy Harmon is one of the great journalists in our newsroom. She's won a Pulitzer Prize, and I have my fingers crossed that she will again. But she did, you know, a year's worth of reporting on young adults who were autistic.
Yep.
And, you know, we did in the digital presentation of her story video quick links. So instead of having a video component that was essentially separate in a separate player, like as you read the story, you could literally meet the main character who in her first story was a young adult named Justin, who was a compulsively great artist and cartoonist. He drew Disney characters all the time. And you could, as you read the top of the story, you could see him and hear him and even see his art, which was, you know, essential to understanding, A, why employers might not, like, be that eager to, you know, you got to see just... You know, he was a really great, talented kid who, in the end, does find employment. But you got to understand what he was like in a way that went beyond Amy's fantastic words. Right.
Using the platform to advance the narrative.
But as you went, you know, not, you didn't have to go somewhere else to see video.
How much of that is top-down at the paper, and how much of that is bottom-up? How much of that is... editors and other people who run the paper and are thinking strategically about these issues, mandating to the newsroom that everything we do now has to be multi-platform, has to be, or how much of that is reporters who own this, who embrace it and basically push that stuff up the ladder?
You know, I think it's much more reporters owning it, but to be honest, our multimedia group is headed by Andrew Devigal, who's just, you know, a genius and always bringing us new tools. And he's fantastic at explaining to, you know, my colleagues, like, what's available. They wouldn't have known you could do quick links until he kind of came to this project and thought it uniquely was deepened by having the quick links, that was the best for that story. And I would never mandate, you know, that every story has to have, like, every bell and whistle.
I guess it's less
that would be like a really unsophisticated approach, I think.
I guess it's less about the issue of top-down versus bottom-up, I guess, than the degree to which the newsroom embraces this stuff independent of the leadership. You couldn't imagine an institution, at least by reputation, that's more old-school than the Times.
Yeah, we were, at least if I had come here 4 years ago, we were definitely old media.
Old media. So the idea is, to what degree are you grafting a new media sensibility and embrace and acceptance of this stuff onto a newsroom that is essentially old media, or have even the old media guys transferred?
Yeah, I think we're past that. Yeah. And, you know, one of my goals as managing editor when I work with Bill Keller was, you know, we both were working to integrate the newsroom so that there wasn't something that was still called the web newsroom and then the newspaper newsroom.
Could you talk about that? I know I alluded to the fact that you spent a certain amount of time under Keller as managing editor with responsibility for thinking about these big issues.
Right.
Can you talk about exactly what you did during that period of time, what you learned, and how that's applied itself as you've now been executive editor?
Right. Well, I'm big on learning. So, you know, it was 6 months in which I stepped away from our daily news report and focused exclusively on digital. And, you know, I mentioned Andrew a minute ago. I really didn't know Andrew all that well before that 6 months. So it was mostly listening up and learning from the people who were on the cutting edge of our digital news operation and getting acquainted and getting smart about, like, how to deepen our stories through either, you know, dashboards that, you know, Aaron Pilhofer, who's come out here, you know, for many years, he's in charge of interactive news. You know, he's, like, made our political report, like, just, you know, a singular thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, on primary night in Florida, you know, you could go to our article page and the dashboard gave you live results as you read, which was, like, fantastic.
So those 6 months for someone who was herself probably would have thought of herself at one point as more old media, those 6 months were not scary, they were hopeful, and they've actually informed your times.
Well, they were scary and hopeful
and both.
It's not
either or.
Yeah, I mean, the scary part was how much I had to learn.
Right.
And the hopeful part was realizing that even in my old trade, which is investigative journalism, that, you know, these new tools, like whether it's computer-assisted reporting or video or, you know, interactive graphics, like, deepen the story, you know, that was... I knew that because I was, you know, a devoted Digital Times reader and, you know, had, you know, become addicted to other sites that have been on the cutting edge, but it left me really hopeful, incredibly optimistic.
Do you think you're doing an adequate job institutionally on mobile and on tablets and sort of all the various other ways to get the times? We talk about the metered model and the web, but as you know, all the action is
on phones and devices.
On phones and devices and so on. So how are you all doing on that?
I think we're doing really well. I am surprised. You know, you can always judge a little bit by your own experience. And, you know, I become completely addicted to my iPad, obviously iPhone years before that. But, you know, that is often I will have, you know, started reading our news report at night on the iPad, and then I grab it, you know, first thing off the night table. And sometimes it can be like when I'm heading to the subway that I actually go pick up my print paper.
Are you one of those people who even entertains seriously the idea that one day we'll be transitioning entirely to these tablets and devices, and that the print paper, if not completely gone, it'll be like the half-life of plutonium, it'll go down to the horizon line to almost next to nothing?
I don't think we're going to get there anytime soon. And, you know, if we do, what I'm optimistic about is our quality journalism is going to live on forever.
Regardless of format.
Regardless of platform. And, you know, there are still, you know, the print newspaper still does really well. We have over 850,000 home delivery subscribers who pay a lot of money for the privilege of getting the print paper and who love it. And, you know, after 2 years, I consider them kind of addicted to the thing.
And you believe the economics of the print model augur well going forward, that there's not going to be a time at which the economics are going to become the problem
I would be a fool to become an economic soothsayer. But what I know is the thirst for stories that are thoroughly reported, elegantly told, and edited in a way that honors the intelligence of our readers and our audience is going to be there.
Now, you know that all over states like Texas, newspapers are not doing quite as well as the Times.
They're having
much more difficult times. You know, you and I were visiting before we came out here about the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, which a little bit more than a week ago announced that they were going to close their capital bureau here after 80 years. We've seen a decline in the number of newspapers and the number of reporters in a place like Texas, but this is really the case all over the rest of the country.
Yeah, I was actually in Detroit. We were having a conference on the economy with reporters from across the country who worked at the Times, and we were there the week that, you know, the Detroit newspapers cut back to like only a couple days a week.
So what are they not doing that they should be doing from your perspective? Obviously, the Times is not the Detroit paper. The Times is not the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. But fundamentally, the product that they're trying to put out has the same values, the same goals, but they're not making it work in some places, and you all seem to be making it work a little bit better. So what are they not doing that they should be doing?
They don't have our audience, and they don't have, you know, the kind of newsroom that we do.
At the end of the day, it's about audience?
It's about both. Yeah. It's about quality journalism and, you know, keeping the promise of it, you know, alive in every story that we publish, wherever we publish it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just the Times is, I don't mean to sound arrogant or self-satisfied in any way, but, you know, our news report is like none anywhere in the world, I feel, in terms of depth and breadth. Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to replicate that.
Well, let me push you on that. So you are often viewed in a competitive set that includes the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post.
Right.
You love what you do. Talk smack about them.
I won't.
Why not?
Because, you know,
they're not here.
No, I know. But, you know, I work for 10 years at the Wall Street Journal.
You worked for the pre-Murdoch Wall Street Journal.
I did, the old journal.
Do you think that the Murdoch-owned and run Wall Street Journal is a worse paper than the Dow Jones paper?
It's different. You know, it's a different paper.
Okay, can you talk about what that means?
Yeah, you know, I was asked about it and quoted in some article, I can't remember where, saying, like, the journal now is in some ways, a quicker delivery system. They still have, international reach on any given day. They'll have a piece. Sometimes it's a scoop on business. Sometimes it's just, a piece about Syria or Iran that I'll think is smart.
Right. Have you seen a deleterious effect of Murdoch's ownership on the paper's point of view or voice? As you know, widely predicted, and the many people who were opposed to Murdoch going in saw the demon in the details here.
Right.
When Murdoch
I guess,
paid.
The thing that makes me inclined to answer no is that, the journalists in Washington, some of them were my colleagues, like Jerry Saab, who's the Washington bureau chief,
yep.
and Dave Wessel and others. But, Jerry is as straight as they come.
Yeah.
And, he directs most of the political coverage.
And so you have your faith in him, even if
I have total faith in him. But, the Times published a piece documenting that there had been some change and a bit of what I'd call political editing or filtering of some stories. So, I don't have my eyes closed either.
You still consider them to be a competitor?
I sure do.
As they're knocked for being occasionally more conservative or having a point of view that creeps into the news pages, as you well know.
Well, we're accused of the opposite.
You all are Pravda or, whatever, the Daily Worker. I don't know which
the appropriate. Well, tell what you told me in the green room about the blue bag.
The perception in places like Texas in deep red states is that if you get your home delivery times, you get your blue bag on the driveway, you better get it up within 5 or 10 minutes or they yell socialist from the street. That's right.
See, in Manhattan.
Not in Austin,
in
but
Manhattan,
in other places.
In Manhattan, they steal the blue bag, but it's for a dog-oriented purpose.
Let me tell you what. When it comes to that purpose, the blue New York Times bag is the very best of any of the bags. I agree. So I want you to address head-on the perception in some quarters that the New York Times is a liberal rag.
Yeah, well, that is a perception that some people have. Abe Rosenthal, who was, very famous executive editor before my time, and he actually had a conservative outlook. He was asked what I call the tombstone question. What do you want on your tombstone? And he said, that he kept the paper straight. And, I feel that I carry that in my brain and in my heart, like in my job. In both cases, because I worked at the Journal for so long, it's perceived as a conservative newspaper because it has, an editorial page that is very conservative. The Times has an editorial page that, on most issues is viewed as liberal.
Right.
And so I think that creates the perception more than alleged bias either way in the news report. And I should point out that the editorial part of the opinion pages of the newspaper and the opinion
separate.
Side of our website is completely separate.
Yeah. Is the public editor who was something of a burr under Bill Keller's saddle by his own admission.
Yeah.
Has it been the same with you?
Always
Keller
been
said he loosed this person onto the world, not the actual person who's the public editor now, but the title. And then many times since then he's thought, I wonder if that was actually the best decision in the end. I don't think he questioned.
To have one.
Well,
yeah.
he realized that it caused some tumult in addition to doing whatever it did from the standpoint of making people understand that the Times was self-examined.
Right.
What do you think
about
that?
But, on the other hand, I share some of those concerns, and especially because, I've been the kind of journalist that's done a lot of tough stories, on powerful institutions and people who have often pushed back with lawyers and PR advisors and the whole works is, those stories tend to often be on the radar of the public editor.
Yeah.
So, but I don't think it's dulled any of our reporters, passion for that work or desire to do those stories. And, it's a burr, because, I'm the kind of editor who, I'm tremendously proud of the journalism we create, and I'm someone who's going to be in the foxhole with our reporters.
Right.
That's just my DNA and who I am.
And yet, as the editor, while your job is to defend your piece,
right.
It is also to acknowledge when the paper has not done it right. And so my question is, as you read the public editor's columns, and the public editor calls the Times out for doing thus or such, do you more often think, yeah, that's probably right, or do you more often think, this person is an enemy of the people who are in my army?
Well, one thing about the public editor, you know, the first was Dan Okrent at the end of 2003, I think, or beginning of 2004. Yeah. And, you know, I feel in general, you know, I have to be thoughtful about, you know, what the public editor is writing, because that job was created to create more public accountability, which I agree with, and have an independent voice looking into readers' concerns. And, you know, in giving, you know, my resume in the beginning of your introduction to me, you know, you pointed out I was Washington bureau chief during, you know, the first Bush administration and the walk up to the war in Iraq. And, you know, sometimes I think, you know, if we had had a public editor then, we would have, you know, Bill Keller is on the record already saying he regrets that the editor's note that he and I crafted about some of the flawed coverage at that point, that we would have been prodded to get to it a little sooner, which would have been better for the Times.
Let's talk about you and Keller. How did you get along? How are you similar, and where do you differ in your view of the Times or your styles as the editor of the paper?
I think that we were a really good team. I didn't know Bill all that well. He'd been managing editor when I joined the Times, and, you know, we had dealt with each other quite a bit on, you know, investigative pieces. The whole Monica Lewinsky impeachment thing was going down then. He was, like, very involved in directing the coverage of that. But we didn't know each other, you know, intimately. We had never worked side by side because I'd been a journalist in Washington, kind of like you're Mr. Texas. I was sort of Ms. Washington. And Washington and politics isn't the thing that, you know, Bill Keller, you know, is addicted to. He, you know, led our coverage of elections very masterfully, but I don't think it's his first love. Foreign news and other subjects are more his style. I mean, he's someone who, I always love this about him when I work, he reads poetry on the subway. I'm reading my horoscope in the New York Post on the subway. You know, we're pretty different, but I think we made a great team.
Tell me something that happened in the Keller era that if it had been the Abramson era, would not have happened.
You know, there aren't big things. I think, you know, when I think of, like, a story that might have come out differently just because, you know, I covered lobbying in Washington. That was kind of my core subject. We ran, you know, a controversial and I thought very well-reported story about the relationship between John McCain and a particular female lobbyist in Washington. I think I should have fought hard to shape it a little bit differently.
What about the issue that was so controversial around the time of the 2004 election, the question of the warrantless wiretapping story and the decision about when to run that, and the Times came under some criticism for that?
Yeah, I know that President, we held it
President
too
Bush,
long.
You know, there was a point of view out of the White House, point of view in the media community about whether you handled that properly. If it had been the Abramson era, would that have happened differently?
You know, I was very involved in decisions about that story, and, you know, Jim Risen is someone who, you know, I've worked very closely with, and, you know, I definitely believed that we needed to publish the story. And on the other hand, Bill was the one who was on the front lines of, you know, going to the White House and dealing with the administration about their concerns that we would be putting lives at risk by publishing it.
And you supported
you know,
that.
You know, the thing is, when, you know, my history in Washington is such that, you know, usually when you're asked to, you know, consider holding a story, or, you know, even more rare, is not published one, which is in this case, is, you know, you put your foot on the brakes for a while, so that it's a balancing test. And the Bill and I never had any differences over what we were balancing, which is, you know, the national security and the possible harm to that versus the public's right to know about what was at that point the crown jewel intelligence program.
Yeah.
And, you know, we, you know, came to be of like mind that, you know, the way that the program was being carried out was illegal, and that as we found out more about the details of the program from Jim Rice and Eric Lischblau and their fantastic editor in Washington, Rebecca Corbett, we could see that that began, you know, definitely to weigh on the side of the public needs to know about this. If you have, you know, a so-called war on terror being waged, you know, in the name of the country, then, you know, the people have a real right to know about the dimensions of it.
Okay. Let me bring this back to the president a little bit, ask a couple more questions about the digital piece. I think we're going to have questions from the audience here at some point, but let's do a little bit more before we get to that. I've noticed since you became the editor, and particularly since Sam Sifton was made national editor, that there seems to have been a rush to embrace social media, as was not the case before. You all seem to be all over Twitter now in particular. In fact, publishing from time to time.
More than 400 of our reporters are on.
Well, and in fact, putting out lists of reporters to follow on Twitter. There's, in fact, on various areas of the site, it says, you know, here are all the people in this subject area who report for the Times. Here's who they all are on Twitter. What does that do for you institutionally to have such a presence of these individual brands out there?
Well, you know, at a basic level, it helps drive traffic to our site, which is great. It deepens, you know, reader engagement with our stories and the reporters who are creating them, which is fine. But, you know, where I've seen the revolution, you know, in terms of Twitter being used in news gathering itself, which I think is where it's most valuable in many ways. It's like on the campaign trail. I I'm a political junkie like you, Evan, maybe not quite as big a one as you are. But I went to Iowa to, you know, go see all the candidates, and all of our reporters, you know, and the political editors, like, have, you know, their tweet deck up all the time.
Right.
And that is where, you know, if a candidate is going to post a statement, it's first there.
Yeah. So first on social media and then on the site.
Yeah, so that the question, I think the sophisticated question about Twitter is, do you break news on it before you have anything to link to? And I don't, like, have a theological answer to that. There were some people on my political team who wanted to issue an edict, like, let's not do that because we're not going to, you know, really have an immediate benefit. But I think, you know, we're still in, somewhat early days.
Well, let's stay on that for a second. So, you know, the argument here would be, if you have nothing to link to, then it's all about traffic.
Right.
You know, we had a situation this morning that the Department of Justice denied preclearance on voter ID in Texas this morning, which is accelerating the fight over voter ID in Texas. And we, the Tribune, made the decision to tweet, DOJ denies preclearance on voter ID, story coming.
Right.
And then we'll obviously backfill with an actual story. And I think that to some degree, people look to the Times to be reporting the news and then providing a story about that reporting, you know. So I wonder if maybe there isn't a benefit to you all to just be the people to tell people stuff, even if there's nothing to link to.
That's exactly.
So no such edict.
No edict. Yeah. Absolutely no edict.
Yeah. Yeah. Does the arrival on Twitter of all these reporters who are themselves individual brands ultimately benefits the institutional brand? Because it wasn't too long ago that the institutional brand, like the Times, might have frowned on the individual brands getting out in front of the institution.
Yeah.
But now it seems the balance has shifted, and you all really benefit from, it's kind of like the David Carification of the media.
right?
But, you know, there's no edict that every journalist at the Times has to, you know, be out there.
But surely
the
if they are out there, you all benefit from them
benefit,
being out there.
We benefit, and I think David benefits because David's sub-brand is so much more powerful because he's David Carr of the New York Times.
Right.
And no one, you know, is going to, like, convince me otherwise.
Good. All right, just a couple more things. So let me ask you the burden of history question, inevitably.
Oh, man. It sounds like such a pretentious.
It does.
The burden of history.
I have been called worse. Are you a woman editor, or are you an editor who happens to be a woman? A lot is made of the fact, I made something of it, that you were the first woman editor of the New York Times.
Right, but see, you're saying it almost apologetically.
Well, no, I'm
you
I'm
don't
saying
know
it,
what my answer is
I don't.
To that
it's
question.
It's neutral.
So he's saying, like, and what fascinated me when I was named to this job, and, you know, I did a number of interviews, is that the interviewer almost always said to me, I know I'm not supposed to ask
you. Oh, I know I'm supposed to ask this. Come on.
But no, but it was always asked a little sheepishly. And the thing is, I'm so proud to be the first woman to be executive editor of the Times. It's like... And, you know, happy to talk about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the most meaningful thing to me has happened here is when, you know, people, whether they're, you know, women or guys, come up and say, like, it's so great that you have this job.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're you know, part of what they're conveying to me is they're excited that they've, you know, lived to see a woman in this job.
Right.
And I'm very glad about that.
But as a practical matter, Jill, does that status inform your work?
It's impossible for me to say because who I am informs my work, and it's like a key part of who I am.
Yeah. Okay. That's good.
And you know, does it influence? I mean, my colleagues, you know, working on the political story, were incredibly quick to, you know, jump on all the news that there's been about women's health, you know, lately, and, the Komen controversy. We were like a tad, I think, slow to bring it out to the front page and really blow it out on the homepage. And that, you know, happened with me at the helm.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what the causal relationship is.
Okay. Well, last question before we open it up. Let me ask you about Barnard Gate.
Oh, Barnard Gate,
Speaking of gender, so much was made, probably too much, of the fact that you were to have been Barnard's commencement speaker this year, and a certain president of the United States jumped in line ahead of you.
He did, yeah.
Let the record show that we were not going to let him take your spot here, even if he asked.
Well,
right.
You wouldn't let President Obama take my spot here.
I guess the
most immediate effect that it had on me is I got a lot of pity commencement speaking invitations.
Did you?
A ton of them.
A bunch of lesser schools.
Well, no, I'm not going to say they're lesser schools, but definitely pity invitations for.
And will
for
you be
me.
Will you be accepting any of the pity
actually,
invitations?
Actually, I decided I'm going to speak at a small high school in New York at their commencement. It's an all-girls school. I promised to do it ages ago. I'm going to do that and, like, sit out this commencement.
Well, come back next year. That's
No, and, you know, I was like, when the president of Barnard called me, I mean, I think she was worried that, you know, I was going to have some kind of, like, diva fit or something.
Not even for a second.
No, because, you know, I recently have, you know, sat through my kids are 28 and 26, so they graduated fairly recently. And I actually went, my nephew, when he graduated from Yale, was, you know, the president who spoke. And there's something fundamentally so exciting and great about having the president be the commencement speaker.
Right.
So I was like, you know, when she called, like, I was excited for Barnard and excited for the graduating students and really excited for their families.
Well, as Rick Santorum would say, you're a real team player.
And I guess, you know, at some level, my inner voice went, phew.
Already relieved, actually, right. on some levels. All right. Well, let's see if you're relieved by the audience questions.
We
will, in fact, open it up to the audience. The lights are such that I'm hoping to be able to see you, but I may not be able to recognize you. So we'll try to go. Is there a mic over there? Looks like we have just one mic over there. Let's just go right there. Please ask your question.
There's only one mic here, and
okay,
we'll field the questions from here.
Thank you. Okay.
So New York Times had embraced social media on the front page above the fold and has removed it completely. And I was curious, is that an editorial decision? Why there's no Facebook link sharing of the popular articles that my friends or other Facebook users have on that top page?
Right. I think still, you know, you can log in on Facebook, and we're still very active with Facebook, but we're, you know, playing with a couple of different things. And one thing I've learned about, you know, being at the Times is that no one likes change of any kind.
Well, there and every place else,
you know,
honestly.
No one does. Yeah. But, you know, it doesn't mean at all that we've reduced, you know, the role or see less promise in social media. In fact, social media is one of, like, the areas that I think we're going to become much more
robust. Well, as we discussed, it really feels like there's been a visibility
yeah,
in a way. Yeah,
so, but, you know, when I give, you know, some talks in New York, and sometimes I can tell some, you know, there's usually an older reader who will be walking very forcefully in my direction, and I kind of know they are going to still be complaining that we don't print the printed TV book anymore. I mean, there are still, no, there are people who are really fierce, and I understand why. I like the TV book too, with all the, you know, commentary on the movies, and, you know, so I get that it's a true bummer, but no one likes us to change a thing.
Right. Imagine if you got rid of the puzzle.
Oh, well, we never would. The puzzle is like a great, you
know, the franchise on
moneymaker. Yeah. Will Shorts is brilliant. You know, he is a great example of someone who's totally extended into the digital realm and all kinds of
cool
ways.
So no threats to the puzzle. That's the headline
for
this interview.
No, oh, my God. My family, Evan, actually growing up had two print subscription, home delivery subscriptions to the Times. And it was because my mother, you know, was interested in the news, but she was one of these annoying people who could do the puzzle in pen. And she had like a kind of crazy tic where she didn't like to tear out the puzzle. So that's like why we had two subscriptions, because mom didn't want her puzzle like messed with.
It is sacrosanct to most people. That's good. All right, yes, sir.
Yes, I'll let you know I'm a big fanboy of the New York Times and also of the Texas Tribune with Evan. He does
Thank
a great
you.
Job.
Yeah,
but speaking of that, I appreciate the fact that you guys have brought in some regional coverage with the Texas Tribune and also with
Chicago and San Francisco. Yeah.
And, of course, Texas politics, we fed you guys a lot of content this year, of course.
Yes, let's say it was a bad 5.5 months for Rick Perry. It was a great 5.5 months for the Texas Tribune.
So my question is this. Those have been pretty successful. Are we going to see more of that kind of regional content coming through the New York Times?
Yeah, I guess we should disclose. We are kind of
partners. Yeah.
But, in fact, what you're doing is something that many people would never have imagined the Times would ever do, allow non-Times reporters into its pages.
Right.
Blasphemy.
Although, you know, we have a fair amount of articles that have always been done by freelance writers. They're edited by Times editors. Yeah. And
but very, very much the exception rather than the
rule. Right. The exception rather than the rule.
So is this, to the questioner's point, a strategic thing for you?
I mean, the intent of it was to strengthen our news pages in the markets that we've been in Chicago, San Francisco, and here, with quality news to support at a point where, especially state politics, the coverage of state houses has been ripped up in so many places, to support entities that keep quality journalism about regional and state politics going. And, you know, it was also, you know, there was a business reason too, which was we were losing circulation in some of these cities, and we wanted to try seeing if by having, you know, local news here in Texas, it's Friday and Sunday, by having you know, Texas pages, would that like help stem some of the decline?
Right.
And, you know, that was a factor too.
Are you going to do more of that?
I don't know if we're going to, I never say we're not. We've actively looked at other cities and are currently looking at some other cities.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would say right now what we're more focused on is expanding internationally in some developing countries with the same kind of quality, highly educated readers that we enjoy.
At a moment that many other media are pulling away from coverage of global because it's
we're
so expensive.
Not. And but this is, you know, for people who are actually in the, you know, in India, for instance, as well as expatriate community here.
Yeah, that's great. Ma'am.
How much of the digital subscription price goes to covering the cost of having a print business model? Even student pricing is high, twice that of the Wall Street Journal, actually, and has driven me away from previously heavy consumption of your product.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that reality. I taught a journalism writing class at Yale for the past 5 years. I'm not doing it this year because I'm a little busy.
A little busier, yeah.
Adjusting. Right. But, you know, it interested me. I mean, none of my students for years, even though the print paper under, you know, a contract that we have with a lot of universities was in the dining hall for free, they all preferred reading digitally. And, you know, I was heartened by the fact, and it may of course been because I was their teacher, that actually some kids in my class paid for the subscription. I know, you know, that can be a hardship, and certainly the last thing we want to do is not grow our young.
Well, but to the questioner's
leadership.
Point, if I don't know that this is in fact true, but let's assume that it is, if the Times' student price is twice that of the Wall Street Journal, why not drop it? If you want to achieve the goal of getting more college students, you know, into the Times family at an age before they're brand loyal, so that they then grow up as Times readers, why not?
Well, you know, stay tuned. It's the first year that we've had the digital subscription plan, and, you know, adjustments may be coming.
May very well be made. Okay, good. Sir?
I'm going to ask another question about pay models here. I used to work at a newspaper that has about 1,000 staff, and the interesting thing about this newspaper is that in the year 2011, they will make about $60 million. The reason for that is because this newspaper has never given their content away for free online. They've always had a paywall.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, their circulation has held up throughout the years, and the amount of advertising that they get per page is always held out. They've never seen the hollowing out of their advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And
in
you're
print.
Seeing that. I'm sorry?
In print.
In print. This newspaper exists in Hong Kong. It's called the South China Morning Post.
Oh, I know it. Yeah.
But you're seeing a lot of newspapers just finally throw in the towel and say, we're going to have a paywall. We've tried giving our content away for the past 15 years. We listened to these Silicon Valley types that told us to give
news
away our
content. News wants to be free.
Right, and it hasn't worked. So it's more of a comment than a question, but do you think that pay is the way to go, finally?
Well, you know, it depends. You say, you know, it hasn't worked, but in terms of reach of audience and numbers of readers, your news report, you know, reaches more people. And the free model works in terms of scale in certain ways. But, you know, it's a shame that just advertising, the amount in terms of supporting news gathering that you can make from digital advertising hasn't like quite crossed. You know, print advertising still brings
in
more.
But reach doesn't pay the bills either.
No, but you're talking about paying the bills, and I'm just saying you have to assign a tremendous value to reach too.
Do you wish that the Times had gone this route earlier? The journal is often
Evan, you're the one who said, you know, Time Select didn't work.
Well,
and I'm a big believer in
timing. Do you agree that it didn't work?
Well, you know, it didn't, you know, you know, it brought in some revenue, but it reduced the audience for, you know, it was mainly gated content in the opinion realm, although some other content was. And it meant, you know, that someone like Nick Kristoff or Tom Friedman or Maureen Dowd, who have huge followings, suddenly saw their audience constrict. And so it didn't work from that point of view.
I guess, would you have preferred that the metered model, the one that you now currently have in place, had happened earlier? Thinking back.
You know, maybe. I know, you know, Steve Brill is a good friend of mine. I don't know if you guys know who he is, but he ran, you know, a company called Paid Content, and he was a very much a proselytizing voice for, you know, pay models. And, you know, he probably would say we should have done it
earlier,
sooner. But, you know, I'm not going to, you know, spout the Gallo wine.
Hindsight is very clear.
You know, we did it at the right moment in its time.
Sir.
Hi, Jill. Jeff Jones from the Public Insight Network at American Public Media. We are really pleased to help you source some of the excellent autism reporting that you did.
Great.
And I'm wondering, as you go, as you expand nationally and even do more storytelling from, you know, the heartland in America.
Right. We actually, since you mentioned, I don't mean to interrupt you, but the heartland, at a point where, you know, we're kind of sending a message of despair about other news organizations ripping up their coverage, we actually opened a Kansas City bureau, like, a little over a year ago. We still have, I think, 15 domestic bureaus, and we've added. We haven't cut back. But proceed.
Well,
sorry.
And as you do that, whether it's Kansas City or Mumbai, what's the future of sourcing and making sure that a wide variety of people are represented in the stories you tell? Does social media make that easier or more complicated?
Well, you know, it just extends the reach of finding sources. It's another source fire hose, in a sense. It doesn't necessarily replace, you know, other methods of interviewing and finding people who are, you know, great representatives of what you're writing about. So, you know, it's been a, you know, I think a really useful, on the news gathering side, a great, you know, reporting tool and news tool.
Do you accept the premise that the Times' sources and stories are not adequately diverse right now, and that maybe there needs to be a move in the direction of...
You know, I accept that's a criticism, and I also accept the reality that you will never reach exactly the platonic ideal of source community. I think, you know, as we expand digitally, like, real identity is a question. I mean, the Times brand promise is, you know, its authority and, you know, making sure the people who are, you know, your sources on any platform are really themselves is pretty important and something we're careful about. And we like real identity, yes.
Yeah. I think we could all get around that.
You know, I think that on the other hand, the idea that for every story you have to have an exact 50-50 balance is, you know, not right. I think reporters have to report their stories in as thorough a manner as possible, and if the weight of evidence weighs, of reporting evidence weighs on one side, that, like, you go with that. You don't create a false dichotomy by having, you know, on the one hand,
just
on the other
hand, just for the sake
hand,
of doing it.
You know, but the reporting has to be there to justify that.
Good. Sir.
Hi. As technology, you know, enables or maybe requires you to expand your brand nationally or globally, how do you think about your role as a local paper in the city of New York and the state of New York? I'll give you one quick example. You know, you did the spectacular series about the working conditions at Apple factories in China.
Yeah.
But to me, the more jaw-dropping series was there was a series about... conditions in mental health homes in the state of New York. So, how do you, as a executive editor think about the role going forward of the local aspect of the paper?
That's interesting.
It
the,
is.
The New York part as well as the Times
right.
part. Yeah.
I mean, you know, we're the New York Times. I'm a New York girl. This lovely intonation I have is actually an Upper West Side accent, for those of you who may be curious about it. It's a frightening truth that my sister and my mom, who's not around anymore, sound exactly like me.
Is that
so,
right?
Yeah.
It's in the family.
It is.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess the thing that is so joyful about being executive editor of the Times is precisely the fact that we still have a robust Metro News report. As someone who grew up in the heart of New York as a New York girl, the Metropolitan Report is always close to my heart. I'm so proud of the series that we did on how developmentally disabled people are treated, which is, you know, a very sad but very important subject in New York facilities. It's one of the pieces of journalism I'm most proud of, as is Charles Duhigg's Apple series, the Apple economy. But, you know, the joyful part for me is, you know, I can have it all, which is nothing I'm ever complacent about.
You can defend the New York Times as a local paper.
I can, although, you know, I'm certainly a realist. I'm aware we used to have a separate print Metro section, and now, you know, for the edition of the paper, if you read it in print, that you get, you know, there are Metro pages, and in New York, you know, there are more Metropolitan pages, but it's part of the A section.
Right.
So, you know, I wish there was local advertising to have continued to support a separate section, but we've moved, you know, we have a City Room, which is like a fantastic blog of quality local news that augments, the stories that we still have a completely robust local and regional news report. In print, too. Do I mourn the fact that, you know, we don't have as robust coverage of, like, the New Jersey legislature as we once did? Sure. But, you know, we try to make up for it.
There are two nonprofits in New Jersey who might provide you with that coverage, in fact. I think we have time for one more. We're running out of time. Maybe possibly two, but at least one. So, ma'am.
Hi there, Jan Schaefer, JLab.
Jan?
Jill, what are your aspirations or even specific plans to make the New York Times a laboratory for innovations in journalism or even have a greenhouse fund for supporting in-house entrepreneurial ideas?
Right. We actually do. We have, you know, a guy named Michael Zimbalist, who is, like, incredibly innovative and, you know, smart, who does, he heads an R&D group. I have a lot of interaction with him. A lot of it is obviously focused on news, since journalism and quality information is the core of, you know, what we do. But it's key. I mean, the two biggest challenges that I have right now are finishing the job of integrating our newsroom so that there is no more, you know, print, digital, or whatever platform comes next divide. But having, you know, a culture of innovation is critical. So, I can only, you know, send that message from the top, which is what I do, but it's not like a heavy task, because Arthur Sulzberger Jr., who is our publisher and leader, is like, he wouldn't settle for anything less than being on the cutting edge. He's a great promoter of innovation, and he's always, you know, dragging me somewhere to see some cool new application, and that's great. He should be doing that.
And you have his support, which is important. Good. I think we have time for one more if there is somebody behind Jan, and we'll make this the last one.
Hey, Clara Jeffrey, editor of Mother Jones.
Oh, hey.
Hi, guys.
Again.
You know, I love what the Times is doing digitally, and it's so forward in many ways. But there's one thing that's still irksome to other news organizations: when you folks don't link out, even when you're taking note of stories and quoting them. And I'm wondering if that's more the idiosyncrasies of certain reporters and editors, or if there's a policy about linking out?
Yeah, there is no policy, and you know, in some of our journalism, we're doing better at, you know, also, you know, I know the word curation is huge here, but to me that's a form of editing. You know, curating and editing right. are very similar, and the linking out, you know, to other quality sources of news, of which there are many, is something that you're going to see more of.
So you can fix this. You can fix the problem that Claire is saying. You wave your hand over it and make
well,
it
Well, no, that you don't wave your hand, but, you know.
I tried. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're just here.
I'm going to wave my hand now.
Yeah, right. We're at the end. Right. Thank you all so much for your patience. Jill Abramson was so great. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.